Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, candidate filing for this fall's municipal elections ends at noon today. We take a look at who's running so far. North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson sues the Trump administration over what he calls illegal cuts to education funding and joins another lawsuit over FEMA cuts. Some international graduates of Queen's University of Charlotte are notified that the federal government now requires their social media accounts to be public. CMPD releases their mid-year public safety report, which indicates violent crime is down in Charlotte by 25% in the same week. An uptown shooting leaves one dead and five injured. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News race and equity reporter Julian Berger. Alexandria Sands is a reporter with Axios Charlotte. David Hodges is an investigative reporter at WBTV. And Eric Spanberg is managing director or managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So candidate filing for this fall's municipal elections began two Mondays ago. Last week, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles let her intention to seek re-election be known in a press release that said she would file this Wednesday. And lo and behold, this Wednesday, she was at the Board of Elections as promised. Have any strong candidates emerged to run against her?
Nope. We're having summer. For those of us old enough to remember, summer was rerun season, and that's where we are. So we don't have a Republican candidate. We do have a primary challenger who Tigress McDaniel, who has run several times for several different offices, including mayor, but never come close. And Mike, as I was doing my homework last night that was assigned by you, I looked it up, and Vi Lyles, the closest race she has had was her first one in 2017. She won by 18 points and 74% last time in 2023. So everything points to probably a pretty decisive victory again in November.
You mentioned Tigress Sydney Acute McDaniel, who is a perennial candidate for various different offices. She has thrown her hat into the Democratic primary ring, but so has Gemini Boyd. Hasn't he run before as well?
I believe so. I believe that's right.
But not anticipated to be any significant challenge.
I mean, the name recognition that Vi Lyles has, the popularity, and again, beyond that, I think it's just so interesting for those of us that have been around for a while that we have gone from an era when Pat McCrory was Republican mayor for a record seven terms ending in 2009 to now you don't even have a Republican candidate, or at least not yet.
Well, I think I'm not sure what that's right, because filing ends at noon today, but I think Thaddeus Grisella.
It says withdrawn right now for Grisella on the candidate filing race. Yeah. So
okay.
Late breaking news there for you, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, before she filed to run, there were rumors of other Democrats lining up just in case she decided not to run. Even former Mayor Jennifer Roberts posed a possibility that she might run. She dropped a hint. Alex, how did she do that?
Yeah, she went on X. Jennifer Roberts, kind of known to make some outspoken, controversial tweets, giving her opinions about Charlotte City Council. But when she saw that Lyles was filing halfway through the filing period, she made a tweet where she said she was considering running. And that got a lot of people speculating, because she would be one of the strongest opponents who could challenge Lyles. Right now, it's kind of just looking like Lyles is going to be mayor again.
It's hard to glean intent from a tweet or an X, whatever you call it now, because you can't hear inflection. But she wrote, "It's a challenging time for our city and country. Maybe I should sign up to run again." Was that a trial balloon? Was it a jab at Lyles? Was it a bit of good humor? Was it serious?
I'm unsure, but within a few days, she put out, there was so much talk about this tweet that she had to put out a whole newsletter explaining why she was not running, and basically explained that she just has too many commitments right now. She knows that the mayor is a 24/7 job of sleepless nights, and she didn't think that she could take it on.
And we asked, WFAE asked Mayor Lyles how she took that ex post.
I'm not sure whether I laughed out loud or not on that one. You know, Jennifer and I served together several years ago, and I have not had a chance to see her, but I thought it was kind of a cute little game. You know, it was okay. You know, you have to find some joy in this work at some point.
Is she saying she doesn't find joy in this work and she's running for her fifth term? Eric, go ahead.
I think it's pretty clear she's lacking some joy with what's going on with the city council for the past year. But I think also let's just remember that Jennifer Roberts was the incumbent Democratic mayor in 2017 when Vi Lyles challenged her, beat her in the primary, and then went on to obviously have the mayor's office up to the present.
So it was just yesterday that Jennifer Roberts announced that she would not, in fact, be running. She had too many existing commitments, as Alex pointed out. But if she wins, Lyles would be running. She would be serving her fifth term. McCrory served seven, Pat McCrory. And it could be argued that his legacy was cemented by the implementation of the Blue Line, which was described by many as a boondoggle until it wasn't, because it's been so successful. Will Lyles' legacy be noted for whatever happens with this 1 cent sales tax for transit that is likely to be on the November ballot, should the county commission say so, or something else like affordable housing?
I mean, she's come so far in this journey to get this sales tax passed. If she didn't run for another term right now, I mean, she's so close to being the person that gets the credit for this and for this to be her legacy, especially with the red line, because the red line was not going to happen at all until, what, like a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
So she'll be able to take credit for that and to say that that's what she did, while, you know, Anthony Fox has the gold line too. So every mayor is getting their own rail corridor.
It's 100% about the transit plan. I mean, for a long time, she's talked about her priorities being jobs, an affordable place to live, and ways for people to get between where they live and where they work. Affordable housing, this is Charlotte. That's almost an impossible task no matter what. So what you have left is the transit plan. And her running again and all these council members running again seems linked to that 100%.
And yet the transit plan will now be in the hands of the Mecklenburg County Commission, because they'll have to make the decision about whether or not to put this on the ballot in November. They likely will say yes to doing that, but then it's in the hands of the voters. So I think her job is done. She has said, though, that one of her focuses this term will be to reunite the council, which, as you alluded to, Eric, seems to be in a bit of disarray following some infighting.
Accusations. That's very charitable, the way you put that.
Thank you. Accusations of illegal and immoral conduct, closed-door meetings in which big payouts were given to the former city attorney and the CMPD police chief. If this ends up being a council comprised of the usual suspects, and we'll talk about who's declared and who hasn't declared, is repair possible, or will any of this be a factor in voters' minds in these elections?
Well, I would start with the second question first, which is, you know, the dysfunction on council and whether that will be in voters' minds. I don't really think so. I think that it's an important topic. It's something that people like us talk about and people in the political world, but I think that the population as a whole just really doesn't pay attention to it. You know, maybe the indictment of Councilwoman Brown may have, you know, kind of broken through for 5 seconds, but then it's on to something else, football season starting, whatever. So that's that part with the voters. On the second part of actually fixing it, I think that's going to be very difficult to do. I mean, you already have this pronounced schism between essentially who likes the mayor and who doesn't like the mayor. And I don't really see that changing. I think when you look at what Councilmember Watlington said, you know, she said that essentially called it corrupt and then walked it back. But what the point she was making is that information isn't shared, that if you're not on the mayor's team, so to speak, that you're kind of shut out. I don't think that's the kind of thing that you can fix in, you know, 6 months, 12 months. I think that'd be very difficult.
So let's talk about the usual suspects, the members of council, and see who's running and who's not running, or so far, because the filing ends in 2 hours and 44 minutes. Let's look at some of the other races. District 3, Councilwoman Tijuana Brown has decided to run. She said she would run even in the face of a federal indictment, accusing her of illegitimately securing $124,000 in pandemic loans in 2021 and using the funds for personal items. She has said she is innocent of those charges, but she walked into the Board of Elections on Wednesday to file, followed by a dozen supporters chanting, "The champ is here." Two people, Democrats Montravius King and Joy Mayo, had already filed to run against her, and Brown has said she would take no questions when she came to the polling place or the elections board to file, but she did end up talking to the media anyway. She couldn't resist, including a comment about her challengers.
"I wish them the best. Listen, mm-hmm. It is a public seat. It is not my seat. It's a seat that was given to me by the people. So it's a seat that I won, elected to that seat for the people, by the people. So all of the people that are running against me, good luck. But you got some big shoes to fill. Good luck."
That's right.
Good luck.
It started out sounding sincere. I'm not sure how it ended up. Alex, you report that she declined to take questions from reporters, saying the press had done, quote, enough damage. What did we do?
Yeah, I mean, her entire entrance to the Board of Elections office was very theatrical. She walked in. She was like, "Oh, you guys are all here for me." She was on Facebook Live recording a video. And then people were there because the mayor had just filed minutes before. And so reporters were already there, but she said that she didn't want to take questions. Like you said, she couldn't help herself. She took some. She did blame the media. She said to get good pictures of her, not photos like that looked like she was in jail or any jacked up photos. She called out Joe Bruno a few times because he's been very on top of reporting on her indictment. So she's not happy with the way that the charges have been reported in the media, obviously.
And I'll also point out, regarding her relationship with the media, there was a bizarre incident a month or so ago in which an email that was kind of fake, kind of not fake, about her, you know, not running again, was leaked or maybe just sent out to other media, and we ended up having to report and walk it back. It seemed almost like a Kardashian situation about who can I not trust in my inner circle. So there's a lot of drama around it. But to Eric's point, how much do people who are voting end up caring about this?
But I want to point out, we didn't make that up. That email that you referred to a moment ago was released by her former campaign manager. It was sent to her allegedly by Tijuana Brown, who said it was a test, and they released it. So we reported on it. That's not our fault.
Correct. No.
Eric.
I assume we'll probably pick this up after the break, but it is worth noting that 2023 primary, the turnout was 5%. So that's always something to watch. I think you have two really interesting challengers to Councilmember Brown with some interesting resumes and community credentials, but you have to get people to come out because it's a tiny percentage of the population that actually participates in the primary.
One of those challengers is Republican James Bowers, who ran against Brown last time and lost by a substantial margin. Might his chances improve, and will there be a Democratic challenger?
There are two Democratic challengers, okay. Joy Mayo and Montravius King.
That's right, I already mentioned that.
yes, former teachers, both of them. I think it's going to be hard for James Bowers because it's a 14% Republican district. Doesn't mean it's impossible, but you do have an opportunity as an opposing candidate with some of the attention that we just mentioned on Councilmember Brown.
So we're moving on to District 6 when we come back to the break. And that, of course, was Tarek Bakari's seat, held temporarily by Edwin Peacock III. We'll see what's going on in that district in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. 38 minutes from now, candidate filing for actually 2 hours and 38 minutes from now, candidate filing for the next election will end. And that is why we're talking about it this morning on the News Roundup with Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. David Hodges is here, investigative reporter for WBTV. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, also with us this morning. Edwin Peacock III was chosen by City Council to fill out the remainder of Tariq Bakari's unexpired District 6 term. He left to become part of the Trump administration. Peacock promised not to run for the job, but on Monday, Krista Bakari, Tariq Bakari's wife, who wanted to fill out her husband's term, did file to run on her own. She will be running against fellow Republican Sari Chakra. What do we know about Sari Chakra? Anything?
We know that she, I believe she was one of the people who applied to fill Tariq's seat. I don't know much beyond that because they were not a front runner at all. It was down to Krista and Peacock.
So on the Democratic side in District 6, Kimberly Owens has decided to run. Tariq Bakari narrowly beat his Democratic challenger in the last two cycles, with him out of the race, and with the complexion of that district kind of becoming more blue-purple than red-purple. Does that give Kimberly Owens a better chance at this against a non-incumbent, even though Krista Bakari has some name recognition going for her?
You would think so. You would also think that the local Democratic Party is going to put a lot of effort into this particular district race. As you say, Mike, Tariq Bakari, those last two elections, you had July 2022 because of the census delay, and then the usual in 2023, he won by 300 votes each time. Yeah. In those elections, I think the second one was 23,000 votes. So a 300 vote margin, needless to say, very slim, but I said it anyway.
And he beat Stephanie Hand
yes,
by 300 votes in the last, I think, two cycles. Has she not filed? She's decided not to file?
She has not filed as of now. She has not filed. So it is interesting that she's not in the race, that Krista Bakari is in the race. And then, as you say, there looks to be an opportunity for the Democrats. Kimberly Owens is not, you know, a veteran political presence. So there are a lot of interesting dynamics at play in this district race this time around.
So as of yesterday, District 1 Democrat Dante Anderson had a Democratic challenger in Charlene Henderson, but no other challenger in any other party. Democrat Malcolm Graham in District 2 was alone on the ballot, as was Republican Ed Driggs in District 7. And incumbent Democrat Renee Perkins had a Democratic challenger in District 4, Will Russell, but no Republican challenger. And in District 5, incumbent Democrat Marjorie Molina will face J.D. Mazzella Arias as a challenge. That changed as of late yesterday afternoon. And anything to say about those races?
I think that District 4 could actually be kind of interesting because Will Russell was endorsed by Lyles in the last election. And she failed with that endorsement by 450 votes. So I'm wondering if she will try to get him elected again and if she'll be more successful this time.
There are
and
four.
Certainly that unusual move by Mayor Lyles of endorsing against an incumbent from her own party, that stirred up a fair amount of the dysfunction that we were talking about earlier, Mike.
There are four at-large council seats that will be coming up for re-election, and they're all obviously held by incumbents, and all of them have declared. Incumbent Democrat Dimple Lashmera, Victoria Watlington, James Smudgy Mitchell, LaWanna Mayfield have all filed. They will be in competition with fellow Democrats Will Holly, Namrata Yadav, I hope I said her name or his name correctly, and Matt Britt. One Republican has also declared in the at-large race, Missen Kim. Is it likely that these incumbents will be reelected?
I'll just add on that Edwin Peacock filed yesterday to run at large in the Republican primary. So reminiscent of the last time in which Bakari was trying to put together an entire coalition of Republicans who are running at large and challenge some of the situations. So while he did not run for the seat that he currently is holding, he did run, but is running, but at large.
Yeah, that attempt by Tariq Bakari to get a whole slate of Republicans on a Democrat-controlled city council didn't do too well. Might their fortunes be better this time, particularly given the the disorder of, that's been going on within Charlotte City Council?
I think Edwin Peacock, I mean, he'll have a challenge because Mecklenburg County is so blue, but I think he comes across as like very well spoken, and he's talking a lot about public safety, which people are really concerned about. It's actually one of the issues I think will get voters to consider a change as opposed to city hall dysfunction. So I think that he could maybe sneak his way into one of those four seats.
And I would think he would have, in the Republican primary, he would have the better chance, would he not? Because he has been, he's run for office and held office in the past, including the seat he now holds on council temporarily, gives him some name recognition, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, Mike. And remember that Edwin Peacock, although the city has changed so much since this time, he was the last Republican to win an at-large race. That was back in 2011. And then he ran for mayor twice. He lost to Patrick Cannon, I believe, in 13. And then who did he lose to in 2015? It's running out of my brain. Someone correct me. But anyway, Edwin Peacock is very much the sort of old school moderate Charlotte Republican. And it will be interesting, as Alex says, to see whether that resonates with voters, if there's an openness to, okay, this is not a hardline candidate. I think I could see him on council at large.
So I mentioned that J.D. Mazuera Arias is running in District 5, and you have not heard at all in this segment from our reporter, Julian Berger, and that's because J.D. is Julian's partner, and therefore Julian will not be involved in any reporting at all on this radio station or editorial decision-making about city council coverage. But now, since we're going to switch gears, we're going to bring Julian into the conversation in a moment. Yesterday, CMPD released their public safety report for the first half of the year. They announced what they call a significant reduction in crime, down by 8% compared to the same period last year. Alex, what else did they say about that?
Yeah, 8% decrease in crime, 25% decrease in violent crime, and property crime was also down. So it was a very successful report, but one important thing to note, this is only from January to June 30th, and we have had a lot of shootings in July, particularly in Uptown.
Yeah, the decrease in crime includes, David, reductions in homicides, rapes, robberies, aggravated assaults, and property crime, down by 5%, except for burglaries and larcenies from automobiles, which increased. Do they know why this is happening this way?
Well, they're crediting some of their policing initiatives, specifically for types of property crime. They have given credit to the Team Scarlet, which focuses specifically on automobile theft. I think you could look, and they have done a lot of arrests and made a lot of progress. At the same time, there's economic forces that are at play. And sometimes, you know, how much is a car, can you sell a car on the black market for, also has an impact on, you know, whether the theft is going to continue, such as catalytic converter crime. They also highlighted their street takeover attempts to try and bring those down, which has been a really big issue in the news. I know that some police officers have talked about just how challenging it is to bring those to a stop with some of the chase policies. They have some good data, but a lot of things can change over the second half of the year.
Captain Michael Carter of the Steel Creek Division released a written statement in which he said, quote, "Our department isn't just focused on making arrests. We're committed to making a difference in the lives of young people." That comment comes in the same period of time that Alex mentioned, that there have been a number of troubling shootings, particularly uptown and an increase in teen violence. And some of these violent crimes taking place uptown have been described as brazen. Just this week, 5 people were injured, 1 person killed in an incident early Sunday morning on North College Street at 6th Street in the heart of uptown.
You can see officers immediately running to the scene after the incident occurred. And you can see some of the individuals who we believe are suspects in the case running past cars with their blue lights on. That is how brazen, how callous this is.
CMPD Deputy Chief Ryan Butler, who also announced arrests in connection with that shooting. Who do they have in custody, David? And do they know what led to this shooting?
Yeah, they have 2 men in custody, and they've seized 7 firearms. The person who died is a bartender Arlie Bryant, 37, at Encore, and does not really appear to have been involved in this. I will say that when I went out there on Sunday, there were neighbors who live in the apartment close by and other places that were really frustrated, saying that these incidents right outside these clubs are a problem, a reoccurring problem. And what we found is that there was even a shooting the night before, right in the same exact area. And I think that's one of the reasons why you heard CMPD Deputy Chief Ryan Butler saying you could see police officers run there immediately. So they're present, possibly, but there's still frustration from neighbors about how do you solve this long term?
Yeah, Eric.
Yeah, and this is something beyond the tragedy of the person who lost their life and the people injured. This issue of public safety and perception of public safety in Uptown is something that Charlotte Center City Partners and business owners and political leaders have been grappling with for a couple of years. And it's really damaging, Mike, because it comes on top of the commercial real estate slump caused by COVID and the hybrid work schedules. This is something that city leaders have been trying to get a handle on, and they just haven't been able to do it yet.
And the release of the information about that shooting on Sunday did not come quickly enough for Charlotte City Councilman Edwin Peacock. He also questioned an internal email to city staff and council from the chief's from the city's chief communication officer, who had questioned the media's use of the term mass shooting. I guess somebody in the media called it a mass shooting when the FBI definition of a mass shooting requires three people to have been killed. That's splitting hairs, and Peacock says that wasn't the point.
What are you going to reassure the public with? You know, are you going to give them facts, or are you going to say this was or wasn't a mass shooting? I think that was obtuse.
So, Alex, has the city responded to that criticism?
I don't believe they have, and city leaders have been pretty quiet about this. Lyles got asked about that at her filing this week, and she mentioned that council was on a break and to just give them some grace. I think that they, CMPD and city leaders, are obviously concerned about safety, but probably the first step is to recognize when these things are happening instead of just hoping that people forget about them. And that's kind of what it seems like when there's no clear communication. CMPD took a good bit of time also to hold their press conference. It didn't come until Monday at 5 p.m. So
I was emailing CMPD on Sunday. Hey, you've got a lot of angry people around here who are saying you are not present. I've got emails between CMPD and residents, and for them to just not respond for an entire day while recovering this is a little slow. The only other thing I'll mention is that I can see the city's point about the term mass shooting. Yes, it's 100% the technical definition of it. At the same time, what do people think of when they hear the word mass shooting? Does it fit into that category? But it is splitting hairs about an issue that is all about how people feel about it. So.
And five people were injured, to be clear about this.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to something. You referenced, David, a few minutes ago, some anger and frustration among Uptown residents. I know you spoke to several of them, and one said he was frustrated because he didn't see police doing much of anything. So you followed up with this question.
You've still been living in Uptown for 4 or 5 years. Is it reaching a breaking point for you at all?
It is. We're moving to Los Angeles for different reasons. But again, I feel more safe in Los Angeles than I do in Uptown. And that's sad.
And that's saying a lot. How many feel like this guy?
I think there are quite a few who live there. I mean, we interviewed somebody who just came into Uptown for the day and had an amazing time with their family. But if you live right in that area, next to some of these clubs where these incidents are frequently happening, I totally understand if you do not feel safe and you're not recognizing a police presence that's having any effect. These crimes can be brazen. Is there a way to possibly prevent them? That's the question.
For those who don't go uptown very often, you should know this is probably not as populated at night as it was pre-pandemic, when it looked like New York City in the middle of the day at Times Square sometimes at night. But 5th and 6th and College are where a lot of bars and clubs and restaurants are. It's a block from the Performing Arts Center, for crying out loud. This is scary stuff.
Yeah, it's right on a light rail stop for the 7th Street exit, where there's also that market, a really popular lunch space. I mean, during the day, it's an absolute blast. It's a great place to go. You just kind of got a tale of two different cities, depending on when it is and what's going on.
Eric?
And remember, you as a taxpayer, you're investing $275 million in renovations to the arena, a new Hornets practice center. There's $650 million going into Bank of America Stadium across town. So beyond the basic pragmatism of we all want to be safe, there's also the idea of you don't want to hurt these visitor tourism economic magnets with persistent crime and people not feeling comfortable.
And I guess I should point out that it's also this intersection of College and 6th and 5th is a block from the arena. I'll point that out too. Moving on, North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson on Monday joined 22 other states' attorney generals or attorneys general and two governors in suing the Trump administration for freezing funds coming to the state from the Department of Education. We talked a little bit about this yesterday with Superintendent Crystal Hill. The administration, with one day's notice, froze $7 billion in funds. $165 million would have gone to North Carolina. CMS was supposed to receive $12 million of that money. What would this money have supported, Eric?
This money would have gone to a number of things. Summer school, adult literacy, mental health, teacher training, English as a second language programs. So these are essential programs that go on in CMS and across the state. And as you say, Mike, for this to come down the day before, I guess, the money was to go out or, you know, the start of a new fiscal year is quite damaging. And then, of course, schools are about to start. You know, August is when school starts.
Did the decision come down the day before it was supposed, the money was supposed to be handed out because that was purposeful or because of disorganization in D.C.?
I think that the notion of this happening had already been out there. But then I think that on June 30th, this memo goes out saying, okay, this is actually happening or not happening. And remember, at the same time, you have the Supreme Court case that was decided this week that allowed, 1,400 employees to be fired by President Trump.
So timing and consequences aside from this decision, Jeff Jackson joined the suit for another reason, which we will talk about when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Julian Berger is with us. He's our recent equity reporter at WFAE News. David Hodges, an investigative reporter with WBTV. Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. We mentioned a moment ago that North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson on Monday joined 22 other state attorneys general and two governors in suing the Trump administration over freezing funds coming to the states from the Department of Education. And Jackson said he joined the lawsuit because he says the cutting of these funds is illegal.
If Congress wants to eliminate those programs, they can do that. And we can debate whether that's a good idea. But once those funds have been approved, the department that's supposed to give them to the states can't just go, nah, we're not going to do that. That's why this is such a straightforward case that I think we should win. And I suspect the department agrees. I think they know they're going to lose in court, and I think they're fine with that. I think they're looking to score some points with a small group of people who want to see them taking action and being tough, and then they get to blame the court when they get blocked.
He added that if the freeze is not reversed, about 1,000 educators in North Carolina will lose their jobs just weeks before school. And although CMS will take the biggest hit of all the major school systems in the state, it is rural systems that will be hurt even more. So the attorney general is asking the courts, all these attorneys general are asking the courts to treat this like an emergency. Do we know yet if the courts will treat it that way?
We don't know that yet. And Mike, I think we're probably going to talk about this soon. You know, he had two cases, that argument, two cases that North Carolina is suing involving federal funding. That argument of the cut that you played of Jeff Jackson, that is the same argument being made in both instances.
Okay. CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill was on this program yesterday, and I asked her how these cuts, if they stand, might impact students and teachers. And she said that they had already moved some money around to lessen the blow, but it's only a temporary move.
We are going to have to cut some things this year with the promise that we're trying so hard not to impact people and the classroom experience. The devastating impact may not happen this school year, but it will definitely happen next school year.
Without the $12 million CMS was scheduled to receive from the Department of Education, they will ultimately result either in cutting classroom support staff, as you alluded to, Eric, certain after-school care learning programs, or it will cause the system to incur $1 million in debt per month. Given the substantial impact of this nationwide, is Jackson right? Is this just a political maneuver that the administration knows it is likely to lose, but they want to make points with the base?
I don't know that it's certainly a political maneuver. I don't know that I would go so far as to say they know they're going to lose. I mean, look what just happened in the past 2 weeks with the Supreme Court and all of these jobs and cuts that the Trump administration has now been allowed to make of, programs and employees who are approved by Congress. So I wouldn't just accept that right on its face, but certainly this is a political maneuver.
And the CMS board also sent a letter to the Department of Education asking them to reverse their decision. Yesterday, Dr. Hill told me that she didn't believe they had received a response yet. So when might the courts take this up?
That's a good question.
The courts might take it up.
Yeah, that's up to them, right, David?
I wish we could get the courts to move faster sometimes, but it's just dependent on what their schedules are, and they're all extremely busy with all these types of lawsuits going on. Yeah.
So meanwhile, and that's part of the plan. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Jackson is also joining 20 other states in suing FEMA over their decision to cancel a program that provides over $200 million to protect the state's infrastructure, including water and sewer services that have been devastated by storms. It's referred to as the BRIC program, the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities program.
This would be over $200 million to North Carolina. So that is not an amount of money that localities could make up, or frankly, that the state legislature could make up.
Again, that's Jeff Jackson. FEMA terminated hundreds of flood mitigation grants in April. Are these funds connected to Hurricane Helene recovery efforts or for repairs that might be needed in the future following future calamities?
It's more about future calamities. So the BRIC program is all about, let's give you some money now to raise the quality and ability to withstand these storms for your water and wastewater plants. And if you want to know how critical this is, you could just ask any of the communities in Western North Carolina that had their water and sewage taken offline by Hurricane Helene. And none of these towns can afford to fix these things. By spending this money on the front end, you're literally saving billions, hundreds of billions of dollars from having to repair it after a storm comes and wipes it out.
Eric.
And straight to David's point, so when you look at some of these cuts in North Carolina, for example, in Salisbury, there was $22.5 million earmarked for projects around the Yadkin River. In Gastonia, $5.9 million to relocate sewer lines and restore creek banks. So as he said, this is such important work. And as with anything in life, when you take the preventative approach, it's much better, much cheaper.
That was going to be my next question to you, because you cover business, you cover money, you cover how people are impacted by things and the cost of things as we continue to see stronger, wetter, longer lasting storms that result in flooding, as we see droughts coming that result in crop loss and other things and depleted reservoirs. Recovery from these incidents are already straining budgets. So it would seem storm mitigation efforts, making changes in advance to mitigate the effects of these storms, would be cheaper. So why is FEMA taking this action now?
Well, FEMA is saying that this is, you know, part of the administration's review of spending and spending that makes sense. But going back
economically,
to your...
has anything that this administration done so far made any economic sense?
I will let you answer that rhetorical question. But what
it's not rhetorical.
What I would say to that in the classic reporter non-answer is, what is really ironic about this is that this program expanded tremendously under Trump's last administration, with Congress approving a huge expansion of these funds. And I had previously reported on how the state of North Carolina was possibly going backwards in terms of its building code and the ability to get some of this grant money. Now this grant money is just gone. Hickory had actually gotten one of these grants back before Helene happened. Its plant didn't go offline. So there is a track record of success on this. There's really no way to look at this. If this stands up and the attorney general's lawsuit is not successful, it will 100% cost more money in the long run to fix
just
these
so things. Just so people know, this pushback is not coming just from the Democratic Attorney General Jeff Jackson. It's coming from the other side of the aisle as well, including Republican Senator Tom Tillis, who, along with North Carolina Republican Representative Chuck Edwards, insist that, quote, foregoing these critical investments will only make it harder and more expensive for communities to recover from the next storm. Again, Jeff Jackson.
This is not one of those red team, blue team issues. Water and sewer, hurricane preparation, this is totally nonpartisan.
And he says this cancellation of funds is also in violation of the Constitution and other federal laws. Did he say why he believes that?
Well, he, as I said earlier, he's making the same argument that he made with the education funds, which is that you can't just go wipe out things that have been approved by Congress and spending that is already in place. Then the presidential administration can't just come in and wipe that away and say, no, we're not going to do that. Go ahead, David.
And well, to the point of whether this being a blue or red issue, I would actually say this is a lot more of a red issue, because the towns and communities that need this money the most are typically rural, don't have the type of money and finances coming in to make these huge adjustments to their water and wastewater programs. So they need the federal funds in order to do this. A lot of the communities that had their water and wastewater wiped out by Hurricane Helene definitely lean red. So that's why I think you see Senator Tillis and some of these other Republicans jumping on board these lawsuits.
So let's talk about something else that's been going on at the federal level. Julian Berger is with us, our race and equity reporter. Some international graduates of Queen's University of Charlotte recently received a message alerting them to new requirements involving their social media accounts. Julian, what were they told?
Yeah, so they were told that they had to set their social media profiles to public. So these are students who are international students. They've graduated and they're on this thing called ORT, which is optional practical training, which means that they can stay in the US after graduating to work and gain experience in whatever field they're in.
So how was this message transmitted to these graduates? Did it come from Queen's University? Did it come from the government? Was Queen's the conduit? How did it work?
Yeah, so Queen's was the one who did send the email out to the alumni and basically was like, you know, this is coming from the federal government. This is a new guideline, and you guys have to comply by setting your social media profiles, whether Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or X, to public.
And one international alum who asked WFAE that he not be named due to concerns about their visa status told us the rules could have a chilling effect.
It's a little weird just to think that, like, you know, your kind of social media presence can affect your ability to have access to America. I feel like it will make people feel a bit more cautious about what they post, if they're posting anything, and you don't know what they're actually looking for.
I mean, that's a concern that everybody who posts to social media should have about the future impact of what they post, because it affects your employment prospects and many other things, not just the immigration service. But the U.S. Department of State says it is conducting comprehensive and a thorough vetting process, including online and social media presence of all international students and exchange visitor applicants on the F, M, and J non-immigrant classifications. I don't know what that is, and we don't have to get into it here, but how unusual is this? Has anything like this been required in the past?
Yeah, I think this is something to note, that this is something pretty normal that we've seen, especially this year with the Trump administration. DHS and USCIS, who are the ones that deal with visa applications, green card applications, they typically do look at social media. And there's a big debate on that. A lot of people say, well, social media, I should be able to post whatever I want on there because it's my First Amendment right. But ICE and USCIS and DHS are looking at social media to kind of determine whether or not they want to give people visas or green cards or what have you.
But in defense of the government here, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but in defense of the government here, it seems to me that yes, you have a First Amendment right to say anything you want to say, but there are consequences to whatever you say, and that does not exclude social media. As people watch ICE actions nightly on television, concerns in some communities obviously are rising. Recently, undocumented immigrants were arrested near school grounds here in Charlotte. One man, I believe, was taking his child to school. CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill says the district is taking steps to prepare teachers and staff in case ICE agents show up on campus. And it turns out that ICE agents will be allowed on campuses, but with some parameters. Julian, David, I'm not sure to ask this question of. What are those parameters? Where will these people be permitted to go if they show up?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is they are now able to show up in public areas, which include front offices, the lobbies, and parking lots. So that was the biggest distinction. CMS was like, they can be in public areas, but they cannot be in private areas like classrooms, hallways, etc., unless they do have a valid permit signed by a judge.
And this is not a new approach. This was in the books before the recent ICE raids, but it's a refresher to staff and teachers, parents, and students about how CMS intends to react. And here's how Dr. Crystal Hill explained it on this program yesterday.
We know what the law is. We plan to follow the law, and we plan to, and we have continued to inform our staff, inform our parents. We pride ourselves in making sure that our schools are safe. And we have been very clear about what is in place and what we will follow. One thing that I think is important to note is that as educators, we are required to provide all students with the free public education. We are not allowed to know the immigration status of any student. So if anyone comes on campus, and starts asking questions about a student's immigration status, we're not allowed to collect that information at the time of enrollment. We have no idea who those students are.
And she says ICE can only enter classrooms or other private areas if they present a warrant signed by a judge. This information is being reiterated as new data from ICE shows a 160% increase in the number of daily arrests across the state compared to last year. CMS experienced a rise in absenteeism among Hispanic students last year because of fears over ICE. Will this assuage any of the fears that Hispanic parents may have or their children may have about going to school, Julian?
Yeah, I think we can definitely see a higher rate of absenteeism, especially for Hispanic students, undocumented students. I think the biggest thing here is CMS unfortunately has to follow the directives from the federal government, and so they're kind of in a hard place right now, by saying that ICE can show up at schools.
So I have 90 seconds left. David, on a related topic, when someone is arrested on criminal charges, their names are a matter of public record. It turns out that is not the case with ICE arrests. WBTV discovered that in the course of an investigation. So why are these names not public?
ICE policy. My colleague Naomi
Is
Coles
that
worked on
legal?
it. Well, as many of the questions that you ask, we could let the courts decide on those things. It certainly seems like ICE plays by a different set of rules than virtually any other agency that's involved in arrest, detainment, or immigration. My colleague Naomi, she did some reporting showing that there's 140,000 case backlog at the immigration court here, and what they're often doing now is dismissing cases as ICE agents wait outside in order to start up an entire new process. And a lot of this appears linked to the Trump administration's broader push to have 3,000 undocumented immigrants detained daily. So it's all about the numbers, I guess, Mike.
Well, we don't have, thanks to you, David, we don't have time to talk about MLS All-Star game. Well, I'm going to blame the media for this. We don't have time to talk about the MLS All-Star game. It'll be here in 2026, so we'll talk about it in the future. Thanks to David Hodges from WBTV, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Alexandra Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Julian Berger from WFAE News. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.